So, I'd like to begin with a story. Now, I want to warn you about something, all right? This is the first of many stories you're going to hear. Kids, it's story time, all right? So, take out your teddy bears, put in your jammies. Don't fall asleep, all right? I'm going to be sharing a lot of stories today, this afternoon. But I want to begin with this one. I'll explain to you why in a minute, why I'm sharing it. But about 4 years ago, we hosted a convening on immigration, a theological convening on immigration in San Francisco. We flew in the best and brightest, this professor from DePaul University. He was brilliant in ecclesiology. He was a little visually intimidating, but we are grateful for his presence. We had gone through a Friday and Saturday of being able to just think and talk together about the intersection between the immigration issue and ecclesiology. He had just incredible things to say. It was not the whole church. It was a variety of leaders in the community, pastors, clergy, lay leaders, that came together for this convening. So the next day we asked if Mike Buddy could come before our congregation and just sort of, synthesize what he had shared the day before so that the rest of our congregation could learn from what he had shared the day before. So he was prepared to do that when a Latino immigrant woman, part of our congregation, I'll call her Gabriella, had something to say. And so Pastor Sharon Huey walked together up with her to the front of the congregation in our sanctuary, and she proceeded to share with us these words. She said, "I am an undocumented immigrant, but I don't want you to think of me as an undocumented immigrant. I want you to think of me as a fellow follower of Jesus." Now, it turns out that the weekend that we had this convening was right at the height of Operation Return to Sender, which was one of the ways that Immigration Customs Enforcement was trying to carry out its responsibilities of deporting the undocumented in the United States. Operation Return to Sender was primarily targeted it was touted as an action against drug dealers and gangs. But the reality was that it hit and affected folks far more than just that. So it turned out that on that particular weekend that we had the convening, that ICE was carrying out its operations right there in the Mission District of San Francisco. There were about four taquerias, the Balazzo taquerias. There was one in San Francisco, one in Oakland, one in different parts of the Bay Area. ICE raided those places all at the same time. It sent a chilling, it sent a chill throughout the community, and particularly for people like Gabriella, who was fearing for her life. She and her husband raised two kids in San Francisco. They'd become a part of us. And so when she went up to say that she's undocumented, but she doesn't want to be viewed that way, she also wanted to tell us that she needed for us to raise her little boy and her little girl if she and her husband were to be deported. There was not a dry eye in the congregation, I think. There was many tears. We knew that we were family with her, and we were ready to do that. And I think it was an important moment for us as a congregation, because I don't think we just realized how immigrants are affected in our day-to-day lives there in San Francisco. And she brought it so close to home for us. So what happened next, of course, was that after she shared this, Mike Buddy had to come up and wax eloquent about the theology of immigration. And he came up to the mic and basically said, I really don't have anything to add to that. And, you know, he was right at one level. There was so much, even about ecclesiology, that was said when Gabrielia shared that story, okay? But I also want to say that we needed what Mike had to bring as well. Good thinking, theological thinking, biblical thinking about this issue and about people like Gabrielia. And I wanted to share that story for a couple of reasons, all right? One was that it's also a way of saying that, you know, this is the first year that EP has addressed the issue of immigration, but it's not the first time that we as a congregation have been touched by EP in the context of immigration. Mike Buddy is a clear example of that, where he really helped us think about this issue in some really important theological and ecclesiological ways. But we also needed Gabrielia. We needed her life. We needed her candor. We needed her vulnerability. And I think that this has become more and more real to me, even as I wrote this presentation for today. You know how sometimes you work on a, I don't know if this is true for you, but you work on a paper or you work on a presentation, and it's not until the end when you realize what you're trying to say, you know? And I kind of feel a little bit like that today. I was sharing with Mark LeBranson during lunch today that I was sharing with them that there was something, there's a conversation that I had with Mark several years ago that I'll never forget. I mean, it is something that, you know, it's funny because at the time I sort of like was trying to work with it, you know, but I feel like it's become more and more real to me. So I was having a conversation with Mark and I just, see, and you have to understand too that I come from a congregation that was led by a man, Bob Appleby, that had a passion for ecclesiology. And I think that over the years, I've been very, very impacted by him and by our ecclesiology. There's also ways in which I think that I became too sure about my ecclesiology and maybe too sure about the role of ecclesiology in the big picture of things. Sort of became an ecclesiological snob. And I think this was reflected in this conversation I had with Mark, where I was convinced. I said, Mark, I said, you know, good theology leads to good ministry, you know. And Mark quickly corrected me. He pushed back and he said, yes, but good ministry leads to good theology. And, you know, it's taken me years for that to sink in, you know, and it's going to be something I've been working on for a long time. But I think what comes out of the conversations we've already had today is this. And the reason why I share this is because when I talk about the table that turns us, or I talk about how the Lord's Supper changes the immigration conversation, the thing that I fear, of course, is that you might think that I'm going to somehow make an argument that, you know, if we just implement this sacrament in our congregation, if we just use one loaf instead of, you know, little biscuits, you know, with the little cups, you know, if we only just do this on a weekly basis, that's going to turn around the immigration issue, you know. And that's not what I'm going to try to do here today, you know. And in fact, if we've heard anything at all, and I really want to use the language of dance, right, that we've been given to by Beth, is that, you know, it's not just sacrament. It's not just word. And it's also not just dance, but it's the interplay of these things, right? Good theology leads to good ministry, but good ministry leads to good theology. Both need to be happening. And so, I mean, I think if there's anything that comes out of this talk today is I hope it's that, this picture, that God is at work. I mean, I think the thing is the more that I looked and wrote and reflected on our own journey as a congregation, the more I realized that, you know, it had very little to do with us, you know? Very little to do with us. So I'd like to begin by sharing a bit about our history at the table, at the Lord's table, as a congregation. And this began 40 years ago in Chinatown in San Francisco. This was before we became Grace Fellowship, all right, before we were commissioned and sent out. So we practiced communion on a quarterly basis. It was the Cantonese, Mandarin, and English-speaking fellowships all together. And I think what we remember the most about those times was the solemnity. Communion that we did every 3 months was a time when the spiritual got serious. And there were two ways to demonstrate this seriousness. One was, of course, to get up and proceed to the table, which meant that Jesus and I were cool, all right? We had things worked out. I was worthy to go up to the table. The other way to demonstrate spiritual seriousness was to stay put, to stay seated in the pews. I'm still working stuff out. I still have some things to settle, you know? And so both were these different ways in which we can practice this solemn seriousness at the table. Pretty simple, until I found myself questioning the motives of my fellow parishioners. Now, if you want to be historically accurate, I wasn't with that church, but I was with another church that did the exact same thing. So I'm very familiar with this. But we could look around the room and look at people and say, "Hey, look, Sharon Huey's going up to the table. Well, we all know what she's been up to. You know, what's she doing going up to the table?" Or Doug Lee, look at that, he's sitting there looking all holier than thou, you know. He's clearly putting on a performance, you know. And so things began to get problematic during communion when you began to kind of look at each other and sort of question each other's motives. And what did that demonstrate? Well, it demonstrated, of course, that the Lord's Supper was much more about us, right, and what we brought to the table, rather than Jesus and what he has done on our behalf. Now, in trying to chart the shift from communion being about us to being about Jesus is a difficult task, in part because it's an ongoing journey. It's not like we nail this, right? But there are things to point to. I think one, being commissioned and sent out as a new church plant in 1983, it gave us a fresh opportunity to push ecclesial questions, including the nature of worship. We began to understand liturgy as reorientation rather than refilling, a time not merely for inspiration, but for detox, using Danny's word, from detox from the lies of a fallen world. So worship was where we rehearsed our true identity. We began to think of worship this way. But I think more significantly, we began to sense our need for food, i.e. the table of forgiveness. We were feeling vulnerable as a new church plant. We anticipated making many mistakes. Also, with our smaller numbers, we rubbed up against each other more, learning how to dance with each other, as Beth talks about. And our sin became more apparent with one another. And I think also we had left the cloistered world of Chinatown, and it is pretty cloistered, actually, and felt intimidated by our renewed mission to be the church in San Francisco, especially in this larger context of the city. And so we needed sustenance to ask this question rightly and to labor faithfully. So therefore, the Eucharist became less of a ritual and more of a meal, and one that over time came to mean at least three things, and I'm going to be sharing these three things in the course of stories this afternoon. So first of all, the Eucharist was where we embraced our shared brokenness. Beth did so much with this morning. And so, you know, the act of doing communion was this visual demonstration, really. I mean, we would look at each other going up the aisle, right? And we would realize that we're broken and needy, and as Beth said, that we needed each other. So the table became this place where we all, you know, whether we are, you know, rich, poor, we needed each other. Okay. Secondly, like loaves and fishes, we began to understand the table as a place where Christ receives our feeble offerings. Doug Lee has really helped us with this, that Christ receives our feeble offerings, he breaks it, he returns it, and he sends us out with more to share than what we started with. There's something about Jesus and what he does and how he equips us that is far more than we can do. And so the table spoke of Christ's abundance, that we need not fear scarcity. And lastly, the Lord's Supper became a picture of what is to come, the hope of God's good future, where the most unlikely of table mates feast together at a banquet. We practiced passing the peace with each other after communion, which was a way to affirm the shalom of God that had broken in on Easter. At the table, we proclaim the hope of the cross until he comes, until he returns. And so our need for food grew, and we increased our Eucharistic diet from once a quarter to monthly to twice monthly and finally to every Sunday. And then, in 1992, as if knowing we needed to be tested, God sent this predominantly Asian and Anglo lot into the Latino mission district of San Francisco. Now, it's one thing to affirm our brokenness at the table each Sunday and to hug each other in the pews, right? But it's quite another thing to resist our deeply ingrained impulses to function out of strength. We began to talk about this morning. Now, our congregation is largely comprised of college-educated professionals who can claim the Chinese immigrant success story. We can tell of our hardworking ancestors who not only learned how to be accepted by the system, but how to tap into it and reap its rewards. A 1910 journalist put it this way. Let me just share with you just this little story that just delights me to no end. But you know, Danny Carroll talked yesterday about historical amnesia, right? You know, sometimes I have the opposite problem. I have historical obsession, you know. But you know, to my delight, it was like Christmas in July, you know. A dear brother in the congregation, he just happened to have these. His mom had them, you know. But two boxes of a publication called the Overland Monthly, okay? This is a magazine, a little bit like Harper's, right? It was literary arts. It was sort of a shishi magazine. It was sort of the West Coast's way to prove that we're as hip and cool and chic as the East Coast, you know? So I got a bunch of these, and there's so much history in here. It's absolutely amazing. But what's interesting about Overland Monthly was that this magazine was harnessed by a wealthy iron contractor to rouse public support for America's imperial ambitions back in that turn of the century. In particular, he wanted to trumpet America's manifest destiny, which had become popularized around that time. And there was much to gain. He had much to gain as an iron worker in San Francisco in America's war against Spain and eventually the colonization of the Philippines. So he supplied ships and armaments for the U.S. fleet. And so it was very much in his interest to fuel support for and to tout American greatness through the Overland Monthly. This is about as imperial a magazine as you can get. This was sort of the Fox News of its day. His magazine heralded an America on the move. Lead, follow, or go back home. So, as the monthly explained, there was an article in this magazine that some Orientals were actually finally getting it. But others apparently didn't, because the same year... Oh, wait, hold on a second. Let me back up. Let me actually read this, all right? So what this article says is this. It says, it goes to show how fast the Oriental, with his thrifty ways and clever mind, is gaining a place in our hearts and brotherhood. And that at last we are beginning to recognize his sincere endeavor to live up to our American ideals. Let the little brown man adapt to our standards and manners of life, and we are quite ready to give him a chance with our own. Now, so yes, there were some Orientals that were finally starting to get it. But others apparently didn't, because the very same year that this article was written, the U.S. built its first immigration detention facility on Angel Island. So listen to this pronouncement from an earlier issue of the Overland Monthly. The most objectionable feature of the presence of Chinese in California is their effect on our people. Their effect has been to degrade labor, to weaken the political body, and to injure morally, in the broad sense of that word, both the rich and the poor. Okay, so you've all heard of Ellis Island, right? Unlike Ellis Island, Angel Island was more of a filter than it was a gateway. Angel Island was built to keep the Chinese out. I'm going to return to Angel Island a little bit, later at the end of my talk, but my point is that the heritage of many of us at Grace Fellowship is that of the successful Chinese immigrant, but made possible by complying with the American imperial agenda, the dominant narrative of power and hegemony that remains to this day. So reflecting this larger narrative and equipped with the tools and education to work the system to our advantage, we possess, as my pastor Sharon puts it, a power reflex, which kicks in whenever obstacles threaten to thwart our agendas, even charitable ones. We are problem solvers, and we bring this impulse to everything, including people. We're more inclined to fix people than to join them, much less to imagine being changed by them. And so we've brought this power reflex into the Mission District, home to a majority of San Francisco's immigrant poor who come from El Salvador, Nicaragua, Guatemala, Honduras, and Mexico under very difficult circumstances we had little clue about. Now, you need to understand that in this way, Grace Fellowship didn't pick the immigration issue. Rather, it picked us. You see, when we moved into the Mission District, when God led us there, we honestly didn't know what we were doing. And so here we were in a new neighborhood, clueless but with well-intentioned desire to serve. With due diligence, we conducted a community needs assessment. Identifying a felt need for computer and English literacy, we created a program to address it. Not wanting to come across paternalistically, we emphasized the word partner in Grace Learning Partners to connote a two-way relationship. Not only would we offer skills to them, but they could offer something back. For example, I'll teach you MS Word, and you could teach me how to make pupusas. Okay? So, why is it then that after just a few short weeks or months that our friends stopped coming? We found later that they sensed our frustration whenever they arrived late or failed to come consistently. Also, the dinner we provided was within this very narrow window of time. At Grace Learning Partners, one learned to make a choice: be punctual or be hungry. In the end, our neighbors grew tired of failing to fit into our tightly engineered expectations and schedules. And this is as much a self-confession as it is a story. I designed these programs, right? Now, far more insidious than cultural blind spots, however, was our relational blindness. And this is so much of what Beth had to say. When Maria enters the doors of our church, who do I see? Do I see a poor person looking for help? An undocumented immigrant taking advantage of free resources? A single mom whose irresponsible life is messed up beyond repair? These are the typical questions of privileged people who are used to having resources at one's disposal. And we somehow expect others to live the same way, regardless of whether they have those resources or not. So at the Lord's table, we are mercifully stripped of the delusion of self-sufficiency, of self-madeness. Here the cross disabuses us of any claim to moral superiority. So deep is our sin, and yet Christ died for us. This is the message, the table. Moreover, he invites us to the table to have communion with him and to have communion with fellow sinners. No more dehumanizing prejudice, no more pedestals. All are valuable simply because each one is deeply, deeply loved by God. Danny Carroll talked about this yesterday. He uses the Genesis argument, right? That because immigrants are humans, and as such are made in God's image, that they have essential value and the potential to contribute to society through their presence, work, and ideas. And not just to advance free market capitalism. We're just talking about being able to contribute to the whole. So the wealthy receives from the lowly, the banker from the hotel worker, the Stanford graduate from the marginally literate, and vice versa. Everyone has a gift. Everyone has something to offer, and everyone has something to receive. Perhaps the most important gift that we receive from our neighbors is a perspective that questions our sensibilities, that challenges our high-powered assumptions. So Lydia, a young mom from Central America, gave us this gift. She said to us, "I really have a hard time relating to your problems." Lydia had struggled to survive in America after being persecuted, physically abused, and forced to flee her war-torn country. By contrast, our struggles befuddled her as we shared in small group about our angst over which home to buy, the safety of our daughter's preschool, or finding a job that is more personally rewarding and fulfilling. She found the chasm between her experience of her between her experience and ours, really, really hard to swallow. And eventually she left. And we realized after Lydia departed that we were losing a gift far more valuable than we could appreciate when she was with us. We were finally starting to get that the welcome of strangers changes our lives and for the better. Justo Gonzalez's book, Santa Biblia, proved helpful for us on this point. Gonzalez explains that the Spanish word frontera has two meanings, all right? Frontier and border. Frontier is associated with conquest, for example, the U.S. annexation of Mexico and Mexican territories by force, or the colonization of the Philippines by scorched earth policies and the bayonet. The American notion of, conversely, the Latin American notion of border connotes a peaceful encounter where two different cultures mutually enrich each other, usually producing a third culture. In our ministry with Grace Fellowship in the Mission District, the shift in posture from being one of frontier to one of border has meant the difference between repelling and compelling our neighbors. In breaking bread with our neighbors, Christ transforms strangers into friends, not projects. In recent years, as an example, we've encountered a number of struggling marriages among the immigrant families that have come our way. These couples have amazingly allowed some of us to speak into their marriages, speak into their lives, not because they were some marital project needing solutions from experts, but because they discovered that the sinful dynamics of our marriages were no different than theirs. In our common vulnerability, we're able to give and receive from one another. Now, I want to move into the second dimension, and this is a more economic dimension. And I want to talk about this not only because the table has clear economic dimensions, but because when it comes to immigration policy, spoken or unspoken, the value of an immigrant is based almost solely upon whether they are deemed an economic asset or liability. And much of the venomous language used of immigrants over the years may not immediately seem economic as much as, for example, judicial, as in illegal or law-breaking. Or maybe biologically, as in genetically inferior. This has been used a lot over the centuries. Feeble-minded. The Chinese they saw us as bringing in diseases, right? Or moral, as in heathen, backward, barbaric. In reality, such language invariably spikes in times of economic insecurity, suggesting that those in power find the use of "they're taking away our jobs" as perhaps politically ineffective. Likewise, you will not find the government using economic rationale to describe the aims of their deportation programs. Quote unquote, national security remains the post 9/11 mantra of the day. So history bears testimony to the fact that immigrants are welcome in America until they're perceived as a threat to our standard of living. What Dick Cheney means when he insists that the American way of life is a non-negotiable. It is why the Chinese were welcome when the Central Pacific Railroad needed laborers, but despised when gold prospects began to dry up. Why Mexicans were welcomed across the border in the 1920s when agribusiness grew, but forcibly repatriated after the Great Depression. Or why they were welcomed back during World War II, farm labor shortages via the Bracero program, but expelled through Operation Wetback soon after. The ruthless inverse relationship between economic malaise and immigrant crackdowns is not something that civic leaders like to acknowledge openly. We see this clearly in the glaring omission of U.S. trade policy in the immigration reform debate. Congress is willing to argue about immigration, but not in ways that will raise the ire of their corporate constituencies. Similarly, as a congregation, we're squeamish about talking about wealth and materialism, particularly in the context of social need and love of neighbor. So in another event, we had Mike Buddy speak at our family retreat for church. Mike Buddy suggested to our congregation that we take an evening to disclose our salaries to one another. Well, we've yet to do that. Let alone have an open conversation about our discretionary spending, our vacationing habits, or the financial trajectories we may be quietly securing for our children. And we're unsure what to do with all this in the company of poor immigrant families, many of whom struggle month to month and live in spaces the size equivalent of one's kid's bedroom. recent reflections on the Eucharist from 1 Corinthians, particularly 1 Corinthians 11 and 12, have helped us to see that blind spots and ambivalence about wealth and possessions have always been. Paul's incredulity about the Corinthian practice of the Lord's Supper drives home the point that what we may consider reasonable and normal and what is Christian are often two very different things. As Richard Hayes points out, what the Corinthians believers did was quite normal for that day. In Roman imperial society, it was typical for the wealthy benefactor and his friends to congregate in the dining room while lower status guests hung out in the foyer. For the church, however, to mirror the class divisions of Rome was to show contempt for the church of God and to drink judgment against themselves. Paul grieved that their meal gatherings were not for the better, but for the worse. They were to live as one family, but they had failed to demonstrate this. So it's been humbling for us at Grace Fellowship to see ways that our poorer neighbors can live as one family more freely than those of us with a lot more. Last year, we had the opportunity to help an immigrant congregation, a neighboring immigrant church, with a spring cleaning day. One of our parishioners made this helpful observation. She said, "I'm impressed by how freely they give away their stuff to anyone who passes on the street. They're not worried about making sure everything is going to a good cause. They just let God do with their stuff as he chooses." And here's another way. I think we've been struck by differences in the way we approach home hospitality. I wish I could have gone to Debbie Gish's workshop today. But I think ours tends to be a Martha Stewart-influenced hospitality. We're reluctant to invite others in unless our domiciles are presentable. Treating our homes as though showrooms, we elevate image over relationship. And in so doing, many opportunities to break bread with our neighbors slip by. Meanwhile, our immigrant friends welcome us into their homes, despite having less room or fancy silverware. On a particular Sunday, a newly married couple, the Castillos, invited over 30 of us into their small flat, one shared by three families. They had just had their ceremony performed at City Hall, where my wife and others played chauffeur and wedding photographer. Wanting us to celebrate with them, the Castillo family rearranged what little room they had to accommodate as many of us as possible. They cooked the meal. We brought dessert. It was cramped and a little bit crazy, but one thing was clear. To honor and enjoy the relationship we shared was what mattered to them most. We were their family. So our neighbors, our immigrant neighbors, are teaching us how to live as one family. But we have a long way to go. We may not flaunt our taste in fine food the way wealthy Corinthians did, but we remain blind to what life is like for most of our city's undocumented who work in our restaurants, harvest our produce, construct our buildings, and keep our tourists happy. Without them, our local economy simply would not survive. It's difficult for us to relate to having to make hard choices between food, housing, healthcare, things that we all take for granted. What's farther from our grasp, however, is our complicity with the very systems that are adversely affecting the neighbors we're trying to love and join. A Salvadorian man, Manuel, helped us to see one Friday night over dinner. He said this, "My friend's farm in El Salvador no longer generates enough money to support his family. The government recently accepted the U.S. dollar as the national currency. This has raised the cost of living for a lot, especially the poorest families. Only the wealthiest in El Salvador, like those who work for the corporations, can afford to pay for things at American prices." His story was consistent with what I learned at a church-based citizenship fair that a couple of our lawyers volunteered at. A photo at the door caught my attention. It was a picture of the President of El Salvador and George Bush shaking hands. Not knowing what this was about, I later learned that CAFTA had just been signed, a boon for North American multinationals at the expense of countless Salvadoran farmers. Destabilizing policies like these are nothing new to our Salvadoran brothers and sisters who draw inspiration from the life of Archbishop Romero. An advocate for the poor, Romero was assassinated in 1980 by one of the infamous death squads, trained in part by a U.S. government intent on keeping Central America open for business. And we've heard many other stories like this from Guatemala, from Nicaragua, from Honduras, and from our Filipino friends as well. Um, it has been these economic strong-arming strategies, but through the use of unbalanced trade policies, regime change, covert ops, and torture, that has led to the very desert crossings that Beth talked about this morning. These are stories that we must be willing to hear if we're to take our Eucharistic theology seriously. How might the national conversation change if we truly believe that we are all fundamentally needing each other, and that immigrants are more than economic assets or liabilities? Or if we truly believed in a God of abundance, that there really is enough for everyone, that sharing does not have to be scary, and that securing America's dominance in the world is not only delusional or immoral, especially when it's done at other nations' expense, but it's also not necessary. So, the final dimension of the Lord's Supper. I want to talk about this eschatological dimension, that the table points to God's good future, where strange table mates will be feasting with one another. For Phil, a longtime church member and one who once confessed to be a closet redneck, there were many folks that he could never imagine sharing heaven with, the least of which would be lazy, good-for-nothing freeloaders that his parents had always told him about. His upbringing conditioned him to disdain those that society considers irresponsible, who don't play by the rules or earn the right to be here. And yet, approaching the Lord's table each Sunday made him think, especially as he witnessed the growing cast of characters filing up the aisle. Phil was slowly being confronted by the wideness of God's mercy. Everyone is invited to his table, no matter where they're from or how messed up their lives are. This was a picture to come, he was beginning to realize. And so his growing friendship with Carlos was clear evidence that the Spirit was at work in his life. A Nicaraguan immigrant, Carlos had a host of health issues, both mental and physical, that made it difficult for him to hold a job. However, he wasn't lazy. He came to our church regularly, always looking for ways to help, whether setting up chairs, cooking, cleaning the dining hall, and he didn't ask for anything in return. He simply loved being around. One person he particularly glommed onto was Phil. And so thus, it was Phil that first took notice when Carlos disappeared. He alerted Sharon and Doug and started making phone calls. No one, including the sister he lived with, knew where he was. Finally, after about 3 weeks, Carlos's family had found out that he had been picked up by immigration authorities and placed in a detention facility some 125 miles away from San Francisco. Now, without going into the details, what happened to Carlos can be traced back to the Department of Homeland Security's Operation Endgame, an audacious plan to expel every deportable alien from the country by 2012, the most ambitious immigrant crackdown in U.S. history. Since 2003, which is when Operation Endgame began, our government has deported 2.5 million immigrants from the United States, the majority back to Mexico, Latin America, Asia, and Eastern Europe. While DHS claims to target violent criminals, the fact remains that well over half of the 2.5 million do not have criminal records. Billions have been spent employing Border Patrol and ICE agents, and over 350 detention facilities have sprouted across the country, which has become, of course, a boon for the private prison industry. You might recall that in a recent NPR investigation that a executive from the Corrections Corporation of America had a role in the drafting of SB 1070, the bill that charges local police with responsibility for identifying and arresting undocumented immigrants, among other things. But Operation Endgame also gave a boost to county governments who became ICE subcontractors by dedicating jail beds for immigration detention. These arrangements became significant revenue generators because ICE funds such operations in excess of actual expenditures. With recession-hit budgets, fear of scarcity, counties have incentive to hold as many immigrants as possible, which is exactly where Phil's friend Carlos ended up. We finally found out where he was. group of us met with Carlos's sister and brother-in-law to see if there was anything we can do to help. Amy Lee was part of that. We then took a trip to the Yuba County detention facility, again, 100 so miles away from San Francisco. Of immediate concern were his epileptic seizures. During the first attack, we later found out, the guards thought he was faking. They roughed him up, and they put him in solitary confinement for a few days. And although there was a medical unit available for the detainees within the jail, as is required by federal law, layers of bureaucratic insulation, not to mention the bulletproof glass windows, kept us from gaining any information about what medications, if any, he was receiving. We found out, too, that about his meal schedule. If you wanted breakfast, you had to be there at 5 o'clock a.m. Why? Because in places like that, you dictate the terms. You remind the detainees of who's in charge. Similarly, when I asked the jail officer about Carlos's immigration status, I mean, where he was in his situation, I was sent upstairs to a room hoping to speak with someone. Instead, the room was windowless and empty, with the exception of one wall-mounted phone. I don't know if you saw the movie The Visitor, but it was very much like that. I picked it up, and I explained what I was looking for, and the voice on the other end simply referred me to another line, and then I was transferred two more lines only to receive vague information about Carlos's status. We tried to comfort Carlos through the thick glass, praying with him and assuring him that we'd do what we could do to help. The congregation sent letters and pictures. We advocated for his medical treatment, and we looked into his legal options. But a month later, he was deported. Now, although I'd read lots about ICE detention, there was something about being there close up that really got me mad. The harsh treatment, the administrative runaround, the limited access, the faceless interactions with authorities all painted a dark picture of what happens when a classification of people are criminalized. Carlos's brother-in-law's experience further fueled my anger towards ICE. Carlos's brother-in-law was a politically conservative Pentecostal churchgoer, also from Nicaragua. He was grateful to be in America, but he was shocked and befuddled by how inhumanely his brother-in-law was being treated. This was not the America that he was familiar with. So there's much to be angry about, but it really has been far too easy for me to vilify ICE and to view them as so many imperial stormtroopers, void of humanity, executing their cold mandate with ruthless efficiency. It was very tempting to wear shirts like this. Who would Jesus support? I actually carried a sign like this in front of the ICE building once, you know. ICE, you're going down! You know? You know who Jesus is going to deport? He's going to deport you. He's going to deport you to hell, you know? See, I can't be that angry. I don't know how to do it. But I didn't have that option. And it's not that there are not legitimate grounds to demonize ICE as an institution, for without question, powers and principalities are at work in such bureaucracies. But the Lord's table does not allow me to view these men and women as anything other than human beings deeply loved by God. Was it possible for me to imagine ICE agents breaking bread at the table with those who advocate for their victims? Now, as the Lord would have it, I was given the unusual opportunity to co-host this very thing, a meeting in our sanctuary with ICE. So there they were, a Eucharistic banner literally hanging over their heads in our little sanctuary there on 16th Street. On one side sat 12 ICE and DHS officials, some local, some from D.C., and on the other side were a dozen or so immigration advocates, including clergy and lay leaders who serve immigrant families week after week. That event got under my skin, and I sensed the Spirit helping me to reimagine what it means to engage the powers that be. Imagining Christ at the table, the wideness of his mercy began to change everything for me. Well, now we're beginning to meet with ICE as faith leaders on a quarterly basis. Like our activist colleagues, we want to talk to them about families being torn apart, how immigrants fear reporting crimes, how victims of crime cannot trust those that are called to serve and protect them. We want to hold ICE accountable to humane detention practices. Most of all, we seek an exercise of prosecutorial discretion on the part of ICE that spares the non-harmful, hardworking family immigrants from deportation. But we don't want to hold these conversations as adversaries. We don't want to assail them or treat them as villains, but instead as fellow human beings that are no more a sinner than any of us. When they say that they're just doing their job, we want to love them enough to tell them that they are more than mere cogs in a machine, that they're subjects and not objects, with the human agency to make moral judgments, and to exercise them within the structures they find themselves, even if personally costly. Now, we don't know what will come out of these meetings. We certainly don't expect to be able to change enforcement policy anytime soon. But we want to at least be insistent and persistent in one thing: the love of Christ that welcomes sinners to the table, regardless of who we are and what we've done. We want to proclaim and embody the hope of Christ's return when a great multitude from every nation, from all tribes and people and languages, Phil and Carlos, advocates and ICE agents, standing before the throne and before the Lamb, cry out in a loud voice saying, "Salvation belongs to our God, who is seated on the throne and to the Lamb." I want to return, as I close, to Angel Island. So I began sharing this afternoon that much of my life can fit into that immigrant success narrative. And as I said, such success comes when we are able to play the game well and tap into a system that can work for us. But there's another side of the story. I wouldn't be here if it were not for a small Presbyterian congregation that advocated for my grandmother back in 1917. Wang Shi was about 22 years old when she left her war-torn country and arrived at the United States dock on Angel Island with great sense of anticipation. She had arrived into America. What she hadn't anticipated was being immediately incarcerated in an immigration detention facility for nearly 6 months, where she seriously contemplated suicide under the duress of months of arduous interrogation, crowded and unsanitary conditions, poor food, inadequate medical care for her trachoma, and the constant fear of deportation back to China, where an abusive mother-in-law awaited her. Immigration records that I have obtained from the National Archives reveals an amazing paper trail of tireless advocacy, correspondence between the leaders of the Presbyterian Mission in San Francisco and the immigration authorities based on the island, appeals backed with money for proper medical treatment for a condition that could have been the grounds for her deportation, letters of reference to verify her legitimacy and fitness for entrance under the exclusion laws of that day, and assurance that she would be taken care of once released from the island. Letters written with grace, humility, and respect for the authorities who received them. After 6 long months, she was finally released, reunited with her merchant husband, and soon gave birth to little Pearly, my mom. And, well, here I am. Now, I'm eager to learn more about this little Presbyterian church that had advocated for my grandma. I do not know how they engaged immigration theologically. I know very little about their liturgical practices, the hymns they sang, or the way they did communion. But this I know, that they welcomed the neighbor in spite of the prevailing bigotry and draconian laws of that day. They were inarguably changed as they received countless immigrants, like my grandmother, into their fold. They gave generously with time and energy and money, as those who knew that they were ultimately provided for. And they treated others, even those who held their loved ones in captivity, with love and human dignity. And they served with a perseverance and stubborn love as ones who knew the one who writes the end of the story. May it also be with us. Thank you.
Thank you, Craig. That was very moving. So are we taking time to talk and table? So question I came with was, how can our congregations be a place that hosts strange table mates, whether it be the enemy or the immigrant who we long to embrace or show a different witness to? And how can our breaking of bread move us from stranger to friend to kinship of family in the body of Christ? So let's talk about that. What creative ways is your congregation already doing it or could be stretched in that way? I think we were very moved by the examples that Craig gave of such things. So how many minutes? 5 minutes? Oh, 10. Okay. 10 or 12, even. 12.
14!
All right, this is the scariest part, so please be easy on me, all right?
Yeah.
Sorry, they haven't what?
I can't find them. I mean, I see them at Walmart. I see them out on the work sites. But we're not. And now when I was in the urban setting, I was getting more of the poverty-related issues at the door of the church. But in the rural setting, I'm not really getting that. And I don't know if anyone, and I realize you're talking about San Francisco, but if there's somebody in the room that has had some experience working with the migrant workers in the rural setting, I would like to hear.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's actually we in San Francisco are about 50 minutes or so away from a place called Davis, California, where Doug and Amy Lee found each other. Davis is a farming, they have this big agricultural festival every year. Anyway, there's a church there. There's a friend of mine there, and so, you know, they have that similar thing, you know, where they are much closer to the migrant farm working community, but there wasn't really a way to connect. And so they actually just began to do a weekly one of the things was that you have the market farm workers' kids. And so they started doing this Bible study or just activities, you know, arts and crafts with the children. And they did that on a weekly basis. I think they did it on Saturdays, you know, and so volunteers from the church would go out and do that. So that was just the one creative way for this church. Because you're right, there's not these natural connections, but there can be some creative ways to connect. And that's what they did.
Is there anyone that can speak?
One thing you can do is check and see if there are existing Hispanic churches. And so what you do then is right. you can partner through the churches. Mm-hmm. And I can guarantee you it's always worked on churches. And so this becomes your project, it becomes you're engaging with ministries that are already there and with fellow pastors who are probably bivocational and things like this. But that might be the way to begin is through these kind of churches that already exist. And then what a lot of the church I go to, for instance, we rent space in the afternoons. So some of them may be looking for a place to land. So what you might do is offer your church in the afternoon, and that begins a process of getting to know them.
My follow-up question was, are the kind of activities from the authorities that you spoke of coming in the ICE, is there any statistics about this going on out in rural areas, or is this mostly an urban type issue?
Yeah. Go ahead, Danny.
There's a new book that I have this week. So if you write me, it's on my desk at home. It's a new book on immigrant stuff in North Carolina, rural areas. Because I ordered it. It's an anthropology book, but it's dealing with North Carolina farms. I just remembered that. So if you email me, I'll see the information.
I mean, one thing I will say, though, is that the tactics of ICE is changing. And so, like, when I talked about Operation Return to Center, I mean, that you had some pretty overt operations that were taking place, you know, like the taquerias, for instance. But, you know, some of them were very massive operations. You might have read about Postville, right, in Iowa. And the meatpacking plant there, that was a major operation that required huge logistical effort and tents erected and command stations and all that. ICE isn't doing that right now, partly because it just looks bad, right? But ICE is primarily relying on electronics now, you know, and so whether it's E-Verify, which is the employment-based, I-9 record matching system, or whether it's ESCOM, which is basically sending fingerprints of arrested people at local jails, sending those prints to ICE, and then ICE will go after those folks. So it's a lot, you know, and it'll be basically a visit at the door of where they live. It's a lot quieter, it's a lot less public. That's what ICE has been doing. And so the reality is that for a lot of migrant farm workers, for instance, they're not even gonna be on ICE's radar. So, and they haven't done agricultural sweeps, they've not done that, you know. By the way, in my conversations with ICE, they're tricky to have a conversation with. They're fairly elusive, and so I had the opportunity to have to meet at Starbucks with the head of the ICE for the whole region of Northern California, Hawaii, and Guam. And he basically said, "Oh, I'm glad we're meeting, Craig, because you know we're misunderstood. I mean, the media just says these things, you know, and it's such a lie." He says, "For instance, we don't do raids." You know, we haven't done raids for decades, you know. And I'm saying, okay, so how about Iowa? You know, how about, the meatpacking plants? And how about the taquerias in San Francisco, you know? And they say, oh, those aren't raids. Those are targeted enforcement actions, you know. yeah. So it's tricky having conversations with ICE. I mean, I think, it really is... You know, it is a wise as serpents and gentle as doves sort of a transaction. I mean, they're slippery, and I think our hope is that we can cut through that crap, you know, and just kind of get to the real issues. But anyway, that's just to say that that ICE doesn't do raids anymore. That's something that took place decades ago. All right.
That's really good to learn.
I'm curious if, I'm assuming not everyone in your church bought into this, and how you had the conversation with people who didn't buy into it and maybe still don't.
Okay. So, I mean, I think one of this flows out of sort of how I began my presentation today, and that is just to say that all these reflections that I provided, I mean, these stories that I shared with you are just that. They're stories of different ways that God has been at work and things we've been learning. And like I said, you know, it's not like we as a congregation have picked the immigration issue, you know. The immigration issue is upon us just because of where we are and the relationships that God has been giving to us as a congregation. So I guess what I'm trying to say is that it's not like we've had conversations about immigration with everybody in the congregation. I suspect that it'll continue, and conferences like this certainly raise the conversation and all that. But I think part of what's been sort of freeing for me is to recognize that God is at work, right? He's moving in his people in ways that needs to happen. I don't need to worry about getting everybody in the congregation on board with the immigration. The other thing about immigration, too, is that it's extremely, I mean, again, it's very complex, right? And so when you talk about immigration policy, I don't think there's anyone, I mean, there's very few people in this room, including myself, that would really know how to figure out, you know, how an immigration system would actually, how to fix the broken immigration system, you know? I don't actually think it's very fixable, you know, and it's certainly not going to be something that's going to be held at the level of the gospel as a nation. I think what we do need to be responsible for is, what does it mean for us to be the church? What does it mean for us to live out of the reality of the table? And again, I think because of what God is about doing in our congregation, I don't think there's, I mean, I actually believe that, you know, that if there were concrete ways that God would lead us to engage directly immigration policy, the immigration reform conversation, I actually suspect that we're going to have a lot of consensus because of what God is doing. But who knows? I don't know. We'll see. I mean, I think that's where our reflections on the feeding of the 5,000, the loaves and fishes, has been, I think, very, very helpful for us and helpful in terms of the conversation about the Eucharist. Because I think that we actually, the job of the church, I think, is to actually believe that, you know, to actually believe that there is enough. And I think what's hard for Americans is that when we say enough, you know, we have to sort of examine what do we mean when we say that, right? And so, you know, if we, you know, when we, let's say if we were to, as a church in America, if we were to try to push the question of trade policy, for instance, if we were to try to push the question of, you know, is it right for us as a nation to implement trade policies that benefit our way of life, you know, at the expense of millions of people in these other countries, right? I mean, you know, if we're just to push that question, but we can't push that question unless we ourselves are willing to live with less, right? I mean, we can't push for something that we ourselves as the church are unwilling to give up ourselves. But that's the thing, right, is that, you know, you know, the loaves and fishes, right? There was enough for everybody. It wasn't like, you know, everybody got, you know, became wealthy. It's that there's, you know, in God's economy, when we live as one family, there is enough. And so I guess what I'm trying to say is that we have to believe it and we have to live it out. And, you know, I think that's how we could also encourage the larger church, right? Is if we can actually practice sharing, practice living as one community, you know, the church desperately needs to see this demonstrated, let alone, you know, the polity at large.
My last question.
Not so much a question, but what came up at our table was the idea that, okay, well, we don't see them. And then Danny pushes us and says, well, you're not looking. And so what about the people, if you have this or in your town, you know, farms, and who's working it? And so I started thinking along those lines, and I really think, our landlord, we live in a property, and there's an immigrant family that lives with us, and we know that he's undocumented. We befriended him, and he's been baptized, and we share meals. And so there's a good friendship going on, and there's a good friendship going on with us and our landlord. But we know that our landlord employs him and is totally oblivious, I think, to the power differential between him and his employee, and how he always gets what he wants, and he gets a lot out of this guy. And as a Christian, we don't go to the same church, but I know he's a Catholic, and I don't even know how to approach the subject with him, because it's so foreign, and we really just think, we're just so programmed just to, like, well, he's getting paid, and that's good, and I'm not, you know, I'm not telling anybody he's here, and that's good. And, you know, and I have a nice bathroom because he repaired it and fixed it up nice, you know. I don't know how to hold him accountable, because I don't go to his church, I'm not part of his religious tradition, but I kind of wish that we were having those conversations, like, well, do the people, they're hired, I mean, they're working in the cafeteria, do the people who pay them, do they go to your church? I mean, how can we give the Pauline advice, not just the Corinthians around the table, but also the, you know, slaves and masters thing, like, hey, look at this relationship, is this really representative of what God has done?
Thank you. I'm sure it has some answer. Any closing?
I'll give it a try. Who is the gosh this is terrible? Who's this slave in, was it Philippians? I'm sorry, everyone's saying it, I wasn't getting it.
Onesimus,
all right. It's an interesting thing, because you're right. I mean, you know, and we see right in 1 Peter, right, that you have Christians really being called to live in submission to their masters or to their bosses or however you wanted to talk about that. But it also doesn't mean that there isn't a way in which these things, and we see in Paul, we see Paul addressing this in this very concrete way. But what's interesting, and I want to use a term that Michael Budde taught us about ecclesial solidarity, you know, that there's a way in which we have to, this is where we really need to put our bodies into this, but we have, you know, and Danny Carroll just mentioned this a bit ago, and that is that I think we do have to find, we need to find creative and real concrete ways to connect up with our other brothers and sisters in the church. That these relationships can be fostered, that there is, that trust can be engendered and fostered between us and the larger, our brothers and sisters in our locales, in our cities, and that there actually can be an opportunity to talk about these things in the context of a relationship. I mean, I know this is easier said than done, but I just think that there's something about that that's really key here. Something that we can work on together.
Please join me in giving thanks to Greg.